You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In the aftermath of the 2008 financial crisis, it seemed clear that crimes had been committed. Investors had been defrauded, bad loans had been given in poor faith, and banking executives had ignored warnings. Yet, in the over 4 years since the fallout of late 2008, not a single Wall Street executive has been held criminally responsible for behavior leading to the crisis, and now it seems unlikely that they ever will. PBS's Frontline series has investigated why this is in a report called The Untouchables, which airs tonight at 10 p.m. And here to discuss it is Frontline producer and correspondent Martin Smith. Mr. Smith has produced award-winning films on financial topics, including The Madoff Affair and Money, Power, and Wall Street. And I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show.
It's really nice to be back.
No senior Wall Street executive has faced criminal prosecution for fraud. What kinds of legal action have been taken?
There are a whole slew of private lawsuits by pension funds, by insurance companies against banks for fraud. And there have been a number of SEC actions taken against banks for fraud. And the Justice Department itself has filed some civil suits. But to date, there's been no criminal prosecution. There were two Bear Stearns hedge fund managers, a case that began under the Bush administration, that had taken part in selling things to investors and were accused of defrauding investors, but that case went to trial and a jury acquitted them.
And isn't that the argument, the reason given by the Justice Department that they haven't brought more criminal cases to trial?
Well, they've said that it's very difficult, and I accept that. These are transactions that are extremely well-lawyered. This isn't like a home appraiser who doesn't have an army of attorneys looking over every thing he does. They have busted a bunch of people at the very low level of the mortgage chain. But when it gets to Wall Street, where the money was coming from, they have not been able. Now, did the Bear Stearns make them cautious? Very possibly. You hear that from a lot of people within and without the Justice Department.
On the other hand, if you try somebody for murder and he's acquitted, that doesn't mean you don't try other murder cases.
Well, this is a central question. I mean, if you don't take swings at the plate, you can't hit the ball ever. And prosecutors know that you are going to strike out once in a while. But that shouldn't determine whether or not you proceed.
Well, do you think that the Justice Department has made a decision not to pursue any criminal cases?
I can't say that. I think that certainly they're cautious. And there's one clue in the documentary is that Lanny Breuer, I asked him about a speech that he gave to
He's with the Justice Department.
Lanny Breuer is the chief of the criminal division. And I asked him about a speech he gave to the New York City Bar Association late last year. And in that speech, he said that he actually would lie awake at night worried about the consequences of indicting a major bank, that there could be ripple effects throughout the economy. Now, that shouldn't stop him from indicting individuals, but it does indicate a kind of cautious approach.
But it also suggests that we're still talking about too big to fail kinds of things, a real concern that if we cause too much trouble on Wall Street, we're going to see some kind of a domino effect.
Well, there is that issue, too big to fail. Too big to fail becomes then too big to jail. If you're worried that the indictment of a bank is going to lead to ripple effects throughout the economy and the suffering of innocent employees at a bank, let's say, if a bank is deemed too big to jail, then perhaps it's because of its size, then we have to revisit the question of too big to fail.
Has President Obama spoken about this at all?
Well, he signed legislation that would make it easier for the Justice Department and the FBI to investigate these kinds of things back in 2009, something called the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act. But he has stated that, look, I know people are working very hard on this, but greed is not necessarily a crime. I think he had a lot on his plate when he came into office, two wars to wind down and a health care initiative. So I'm not sure that he paid a lot of attention to this.
Well, there are some people who would say that there are just too many Wall Street insiders in his administration, and that he'd be given certain kinds of advice that might deter him from pushing for this. In another case, Congress, when Jamie Dimon appeared before Congress, you would have thought that he was the president of some major country, not the head of a bank.
Well, these guys on Capitol Hill do receive a lot of funding from the banks, the bank lobby, and it helps them get reelected, many of them. On the other hand, I think what we tried to do in the documentary is follow evidence that we could clearly state. To go out there and say that there was some conspiracy at the top of the administration to go soft on the banks, there's a lot of circumstantial evidence. The Timothy Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, said that he doesn't believe in Old Testament justice. The president has said he wants to move forward, and they were worried about the health of the banks. But there are a lot of prosecutors that would like to put a notch in their belt and go after the banks. And so whether they were influenced by this or not, I can't say.
Well, one of the arguments is that the behavior of the banks and the people on Wall Street blurred the line between what's legal and what is not.
Well, yeah. Some people have said to me that this was perhaps the perfect crime. You have armies of attorneys on both sides of any transaction. You have sophisticated investors or so-called sophisticated investors. I'm not sure all of them were aware of what they were buying into. And in Europe, we've seen a different response. We've seen people indicted. But it's hard to know.
Well, also, some say that the financial industry can develop new practices at a rate faster than government regulation can keep up with.
I had this point made to me over and over again. You know, when there's one of these cases, the banks will inundate investigators with literally millions of documents. And searching through those documents and trying to find the needle in the haystack is an enormously difficult undertaking and very expensive, takes a long time. On the other hand, when the Justice Department, Obama's Justice Department, came into office, they said that they were going to pursue this as a top priority. And it just boggles me that after all of this, you haven't seen one prosecution. During the S&L crisis, you had 1,000 bankers indicted and 300 of them top executives went to jail.
My guest is Martin Smith, who is a frontline producer and correspondent. His latest is called The Untouchables. It will be broadcast tonight at 10 on PBS stations. What did you hear that executives on Wall Street banks of Wall Street banks thought would be the repercussions in 2008?
You know, I couldn't get any Wall Street executive to go on camera to say this. But I've had conversations with people that have worked in the banks, and they expected there to be some prosecutions. I spoke to a prominent attorney, David Boyce, who's represented plaintiffs against the banks as well as represented many banks, his firm. And he says in the documentary certainly that people on Wall Street were nervous and they expected to see some significant prosecutions.
Didn't a number of people from the industry you spoke to feel that it would be fairly easy to make a case of fraud, but that they hadn't been approached by anyone in the FBI or the Justice Department?
One of the surprises on the production for me was how easy it was to find so-called whistleblowers out there, some of them who had many of them who'd never been called by anybody in government. No U.S. attorneys, no Justice Department phone calls. These are people that worked in what's called the due diligence operations, which is central to how the bank assesses the credit risk that they're taking on by buying these mortgages. And so these people were reporting really alarming rates of defects.
Now, many of them were contractors, weren't they?
That's right. When the investment banks got involved in the mortgage business, they didn't have offices all around the country like Wells Fargo or Bank of America. So they had to put together infrastructure very quickly, and most of those investment banks would go to these due diligence underwriter contractors. And these would be people that would be brought in to go through the loans and sample them and tell the banks what they were like.
And when they told the banks, well, I don't think this is a good loan, they often got word back that they should change the standards.
Yeah. They were told to loosen the standards. This is what they report over and over again. And there's several of these people that we interview on camera and many more that we were able to talk to off camera.
Have the due diligence underwriters given testimony against the banks that contracted them?
They're giving,
in any cases?
They're giving testimony against the banks in private lawsuits. The private plaintiffs have been far way ahead of the government in pursuing the banks for fraud.
In fact, now, as you report, government is going to all of these private law firms to find people who might want to testify.
Yeah, they've subpoenaed their the testimony of their witnesses.
So the banks, so the law firms are doing a better job than the FBI. The FBI has a department that's supposed to be investigating all of this, doesn't it?
Yeah, and the FBI, yeah, sure. And the FBI, you know, started this really in terrible shape because when the financial crisis hit, they really had a paucity of investigators looking into financial fraud. Since 2001, so many of the investigators in the FBI had been moved to work terrorism cases. And so the government found itself with its pants down when the crisis hit in 2007, 2008.
Well, have they brought people back into the department?
That was the purpose of the Financial Fraud and Recovery Act that the president signed in May of 2009, was to do a number of things, was to change the nation's fraud statutes, but also to give money to the FBI, the SEC, and the Justice Department to beef up their financial crimes units.
And what's happened? Why hasn't it been effective?
That's a good question. The answer you get by talking to people at the FBI and SEC and the Justice Department is that they've tried and they've made this a top priority, but they just can't make these cases. Now, Wall Street makes the argument that, look, we didn't commit crimes. We were just deluded.
By whom?
Well, by the bubble. Bubbles are delusions, right? Mass delusions. On the other hand, I've had too many people inside banks say, no, 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 people were cutting corners and it's more than just delusion going on here. But the public comment that the banks will make is that they were deluded but that they weren't doing this to intentionally defraud anybody. But I think if you read the contracts in some of these cases, you get a different picture.
And you include a shocking TV ad for Countrywide which pretty much says it doesn't matter if you have a job, if you have a bad credit rating, we will work with you.
A loan for every customer was the slogan.
Let's take a little break, and when we come back, we will come back to Countrywide and some of the other Citigroup and some of the other people involved in this discussion that is stimulated by a new show from PBS's Frontline series called The Untouchables. It's being broadcast tonight at 10 o'clock. And talking with me is Frontline producer and correspondent Martin Smith. We are back with Martin Smith. He is the producer and correspondent on a Frontline show called The Untouchables. It will be broadcast tonight at 10 on PBS stations. Last December, state and federal authorities decided against indicting HSBC in a money laundering case over concerns that the charges could jeopardize the bank and ultimately destabilize the financial system. In some sense, are the banks, again, as you mentioned earlier, too big to jail?
Well, apparently. They were worried in that case that it would have repercussions, and so better to give them something called a deferred prosecution agreement And this is something that the Justice Department prefers when it comes to the banks, to kind of give them a warning, give them a sort of a slap, and tell them if you do it again, you're going to be in worse trouble, but not to, to jeopardize the bank's operations.
But what they did was obviously criminal, and what they wound up with was a fine, a large fine. But for a bank like HSBC, it just means a little bite out of their profits.
Yeah, no, it's nothing.
So it's almost like the cost of doing business.
Right, and you exactly. And you question whether or not there's any deterrence here at all, because I mean, that's the point of justice, is to deter people from bad behavior in the future. We have regulators. We're trying in Washington to strengthen regulations for possible – well, to make the markets healthier. But if people who engaged in reckless criminal behavior are not found out, isolated, punished, really, what have you achieved?
Let's talk about Countrywide. Tell me about
Countrywide.
Countrywide, I'm sorry, which is on my side, I guess. That's the confusion. It got a bit confusing there. Who is Michael Winston?
Michael Winston is a management consultant. He doesn't work in the mortgage department per se at Countrywide. He had been around several Fortune 500 companies as a management consultant, and these are people that are brought in to try to make things operate more smoothly. This is something that rating agencies pay attention to, in fact, and they want to know that there's a succession plan for the leader, you know, things that, that investors care about. So he was brought in to do that kind of work. He was told that the goal of the company was to become the Goldman Sachs on the Pacific.
He describes an encounter he had shortly after beginning at Countrywide that made him question their practices. What was that?
He was in the parking lot, and he saw a license plate on one of the cars there, and it was a vanity plate that said, fund them. And there was a guy nearby, and he didn't know if it was the owner of the car or not, and he just turned to him and he says, look at that. What do you think that means? And the guy said, oh, well, that's Angelo Mozzillo, the CEO of Countrywide. That's his growth strategy. And Winston was sort of befuddled and says, this is all in the documentary, and he tells it better than I can, but that he said, well, what criteria do you use? You know, what if they don't have any income? Oh, fund them. Oh, what if they don't have any assets? Fund them. And he said, well, really? And he says, yeah. And if they can fog a mirror, we'll give them a loan.
So did Countrywide play a big role in creating the financial crisis?
Well, that's an interesting question, really, because Countrywide was at the bottom of the chain in terms of originating mortgages. So, yes, they were allowing anybody who could fog a mirror to get a loan. But where was the money coming from? The money was coming from their sales to Wall Street. They were selling the loans that they were writing. The demand was coming from Wall Street. So Wall Street was packaging these things up and selling them on and then giving the money back to Countrywide to make more loans.
Do we know how aware Wall Street was of how bad these loans were?
Yes, absolutely. They were not flying blind. They wanted to know the quality of the loans that they were buying from Countrywide.
So criminal decisions were made, weren't they?
That's what people tell us over and over again, that these guys were knowingly, intentionally buying loans from Countrywide, again, from just about anybody. By 2007, lending standards had really declined. And the banks knew the quality because they hired due diligence underwriters to go through them, sample them, and they knew that the defect rates were rising. So, if they then sell those, you know, it's not illegal for me to sell you a bunch of junk if I tell you it's junk. The problem is if I sell you something and I say it's quality A and it's not, that it's quality B. And that's what happened in many of these instances with these banks.
Well, that sounds like fraud.
It is fraud.
So has anybody been held to account? Has Angelo Mozzillo been indicted?
Angela Mozzillo was investigated by the Justice Department, but they dropped their investigation. The U.S. Attorney's Office in Los Angeles dropped their investigation for reasons that aren't clear. And the SEC did go forward and fine him, and he paid personally about $22 million, $22.5 million, out of pocket, and he was barred from the industry. But you know, that amounted to something like 5% of what he made during the bubble. So that's not a huge fine for him. Other fines were levied, I think, in his case against Bank of America, but they were minor.
Why do you think someone like Martha Stewart paid so heavily for what seems to be a rather minor transaction?
You know, there have been a lot of indictments of various other kinds in recent years. Famously, Raj Rajaratnam, the Goldman Sachs executive for insider trading, Bernie Madoff. In fact, oddly, when one of my first calls to the Justice Department was talking with them and saying, you know, nobody's really been held to account for mortgage fraud by the criminal division at the Justice Department. And so the answer was, no, there's people that have been punished. And I said, well, nobody on Wall Street. And they said, well, no. How about Bernie Madoff? And I said, well, I mean, I was—
He had a Ponzi scheme.
Yeah, and he had a Ponzi scheme. Insider trading, Ponzi schemes, these are things that sort of infest our markets and get rooted out, and all for the better that they do. It took them a while to get Bernie Madoff, 30 years. But that's not what caused the financial crisis. That's not what caused people to lose their homes, to lose their jobs, and for businesses all around the country to see declining demand.
And people looked the other way for a long time, as you suggest, when Bernie Madoff's name came up and people said there were all these red flags. All the investigative agencies pretty much ignored.
Well, it never ceases to amaze me how much what I have to call dumb money is out there, people who blindly invest and don't ask really pretty basic questions that you would know to ask from reading a couple of issues of Money magazine. There's just an alarming amount of money that's out there and is going to people who are not being looked at either by the person, the client who's placing their money with them, or by the government. I think the government is trying to do a better job of this, but we see in the case of mortgage fraud at the banks, no prosecutions.
My guest is Martin Smith, who is a Frontline producer and correspondent. His film, The Untouchables, will be broadcast tonight on PBS stations at 10 o'clock. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So let's talk a bit about Citigroup. Richard Bowen, who worked for Citigroup, was one of the most prominent whistleblowers in the financial crisis. What did he reveal?
He was a senior vice president and chief mortgage underwriter for Citi Mortgage, a subsidiary of Citigroup. And he had the responsibility for tens of billions of dollars worth of mortgages. And he started sounding the alarms in 2006 and was very frustrated as time went by. He was finding defect rates of over 60%. And by the end of 2007, that had gone even higher. And so he, in frustration in November of 2007, he writes an email to Robert Rubin, the chairman of the board at that time.
Who's also been involved in the Obama administration.
Rubin was Secretary of the Treasury.
For Clinton.
Earlier.
But I think he's been an advisor
Yes.
as well.
I mean, he's a player, let's put it that way. And Rubin recalls this. He was brought before the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission that was a fact-finding commission looking into this, and Bowen testified, and then they had Rubin, and he said, "I recall this, but he said, I'm certain that it was referred to the right people, and Citi has said that actions were taken. However, in a 2012 trial, Citibank was admitted that they had faulty due diligence. exact chart, the kind of charges that Bowen was making.
And what happened to Bowen when he called attention to all of these defective mortgages?
Well, eventually he left the bank. The exact terms on which he left are mysterious, and I think there's a non-disclosure agreement. I can only speculate here, but you reach a stone wall in talking about that. But clearly he says he went from supervising 220 people down to supervising two. I said, well, that's a demotion. And he says, well, the bank won't call it that. I said, well, okay. But basically a year later he left. He was basically asked not to come in, according to Bowen. Anyway, the proof is in the pudding, and that is that the Citibank admitted to faulty due diligence.
Now, not everyone in government is looking the other way. You focus a lot on the role that Senator Ted Kaufman played in investigating the banks responsible for the financial crisis. But he wound up leaving Congress in total frustration.
Yeah, and he came in with very high hopes. He was the chief of staff for Joe Biden. And when Biden was became vice president, Ted Kaufman, was asked to step in and fill out the 2 years of his term, 2009-2010. Kaufman, therefore, had taken no money from any lobby and vowed not to run, so he wasn't going to have to raise money for a future election. So he was determined. He had a master's in finance from Wharton. He was determined to bring Wall Street to account, and he was on the Judiciary Committee. He called the chief of the criminal division, Lanny Brewer, the chief enforcer at the SEC, Robert Kuzami, and the head of the Financial Crimes Division, Kevin Perkins at the FBI, in to explain. And he said early on in a press interview that he was definitely going to make sure there was action taken. He leaves in 2010. As you'll see in the documentary, he leaves quite a disappointed man.
And some of the big players were called to appear before various committees. Lloyd Blankfein, James Dimon, testified on their firm's practices. What did they say?
Well, you know, they say a lot of different things. Most famously, the biggest showdown really is between Carl Levin's subcommittee on investigations, on which Ted Kaufman, by the way, sat. Lloyd Blankfein is brought before that to explain how it was that they were packaging up CDOs, selling them to investors, and then betting against them. And there's been a lot of coverage of this. Blankfein simply said, "Well, we're market makers. We can sell. We can short. We can do whatever we want in this market, and there's nothing illegal with it." Well, Levin didn't think so. He thought, and Kaufman, they were appalled by the behavior, and referred it on to the Justice Department. The Justice Department did not bring charges.
And Goldman Sachs has just given Lloyd Blankfein a huge raise this year.
I wanted to point out that the SEC did fine him $500 million, which was a large fine, but not large by Goldman's standards, perhaps. Lloyd Blankfein got a 75% raise. I don't know about you, but I haven't seen one like that.
Well, could you talk to my bosses later?
I will.
After the Enron scandal in the early 2000s, the Sarbanes-Oxley Act was passed to hold executives personally responsible for corporate financial statements. How has that act been used in these cases, or has it just been totally ignored?
Well, I don't think it's been ignored. I think it's been carefully lawyered. I think that the CEOs, chief financial officers, the higher-ups, sign off on the financial statements of their companies, but they're very careful to lawyer and to get the advice of attorneys. And once they've done that, they're protected to a large degree from violations of Sarbanes-Oxley.
New York State is suing J.P. Morgan because of mortgage securities sold by Bear Stearns, which it acquired. Why has this legal action taken so long to happen?
You know, I talk to people inside this new working group that the New York Attorney General sits on, other people sit on it, and ask them when they started this new working group, which was announced by President Obama in January of 2012, a year ago. I said, well, when you got into this working group and you're going to go after mortgage fraud and yeah, maybe it's late in the game, but what did you find in the pipeline? What was there at Justice? What was going on? And I was told there was nothing in the pipeline. And I mean, that's pretty shocking. It was shocking to me that nothing was going on. But Schneiderman, that's a significant lawsuit. Now, it's a civil suit, and it doesn't prosecute individuals for crimes. But it's the first time that the government has taken on this question, and he is, as he says in the documentary, clear that these were intentional, deliberate actions taken on the part of the bank to defraud people.
Well, it's widely reported that the big banks did well in 2012. Do you think that just adds to the public's cynicism in regard to this?
Absolutely. I think that people, you know, I've never worked on a documentary where when I told people what I was doing, I got more sort of enthusiasm all along the way. People want a sense of closure. They want a sense that the Justice Department is working for them. And I think if the Justice Department would simply step up to the plate and take some swings, they may lose these cases. Wall Street has a lot of good attorneys. These transactions are well lawyered. I'm not claiming in this documentary that this is easy. On the other hand, the public has grown more cynical because they feel the government isn't trying.
And do you think that the lack of criminal charges makes it more likely that similar behavior will happen again in the future?
Well, as Senator Grassley of Iowa says in the documentary, if heads don't roll, then, you know, it doesn't get anybody's attention.
One of the we've talked about a lot of the things that you cover in the documentary, but one of the reasons to watch this documentary, you do cover other material, but also is just to look at the faces of the people that you're talking to. And it's just amazing when you read some of the body language. I'm sure you, in going over the editing, thought a lot about that.
Well, I've always been attracted to documentary filmmaking because there's a lot of stuff that doesn't show up in the transcript that you can't put in. I mean, you know, writers have other tricks. But there is nothing like looking at a face and seeing how people respond and how they when and where they scratch and wink or look away.
The Untouchables will be broadcast tonight at 10 p.m. as part of the Frontline series. Thank you so much, Martin Smith, the producer and also the correspondent on this, the person who does all the interviewing, for being on our show today.
Leonard, thank you very much.